1 Corinthians 15, verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I declare unto you the gospel which I preached unto you, which also you have received, and wherein you stand, by which also you are saved, if you keep in memory what I preached unto you, unless you have believed in vain. For I delivered unto you first of all, which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and he was buried, and he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and he was seen of Cephas and of the 12. So our key concern there is the word according to the Scriptures. Again, the background of these writings are the events of the Old Testament. Remember, the Old Testament is, it has doctrine, theology. It also has experiences, encounters. In this instance, wars, modes of worship, you know, and all of that. In between human experiences is God's theology and all of that. Or the theology of Christ in God. And so, our study, therefore, must be deliberate. We mustn't ignore any detail whatsoever. And later on, we looked at the Hebrews 11. And, you know, we said you can evade it in Paul's letters. Paul's letters were straight away cryptic. He just used words, spiritually speaking. He just used it spiritually speaking. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 and 4. What else do we have? Well, 1 Corinthians 9, I fight as one that beats the air. 1 Corinthians 9, 25. Is that 25 or 26? Where he speaks about the ministers, he that warreth, entangled, this life, 2 Timothy 2, 4, 3, 4, 5, 2 Timothy 4, 7, afford the good fight, 1 Timothy 6, 12, fight the good fight of faith, then maybe Jude 3, contend earnestly. So that's for us an escape route because it's already imaged. You know, but then the writer of Hebrews throws in the problem, which, you know, of all the writers of the epistles, he was the only one who took a historical formatting of, unlike Stephen. Stephen was theological. Stephen just said, yes, this happened for the purpose of the worship of Yahweh. He mentioned the angel in the church in the wilderness and up to the rejection of the sent one. But the writer of Hebrews doesn't just do that. He brings the experiences to our faces, the very experience of Abel and then the animal offered. Then we mentioned that Enoch who was translated, he shouldn't see death. Then Noah's ark, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the way they were dwelling in tabernacles, Sarah having a child, being offered, looking at the stars. He brings the experiences to our faces. The conquest in Egypt, Joseph in Egypt, the way he blessed his children. Then Moses, how he was born, how he fled, how he came back, how they had the Passover, how the firstborn was destroyed, how people were destroyed. So he brings the experiences to us, which means that his audience were made to read those experiences again. Now, to know how they were taught, and the way they thought, will be to now read Hebrews 13:1, where he says, let brotherly love continue, where you have the word philadelphos, or philadelphia as we call it today, and then he talks about the sacrifice that is acceptable unto God, which is good works to do good, Hebrews 13, verse 16. Having said that, no doubt, it therefore means that for using the conquest as articles of faith, in chapter 11, verse 33 down, it means that there's an interpretation they have done. I think I was discussing this with some folks that it now appears glaring that the easiest to read are the epistles. It appears glaring that it's like, I don't want to be caught making anything that look cliche, but it appears that really the study of scripture is to study the Old Testament. Because that is what the audience of the apostles had. That was what they understood. It is that understanding that was followed up by the epistles. So they understood what we are discussing today. They understood the context of the words, the theology and the grammars of the words. And of course, the worship, the mode of worship, the issue of the temple. Like I mentioned earlier, Hebrews 8 and 5, when he was about to build, he was told, according to pattern. And the writer says that it was a shadow, a type towards skia and tupos. In other words, what he did, alright, was not for a literal worship. But like I said earlier, Moses schooled in Egypt and all he had to depict worship, let me say this in very clean terms. The imagery he will use is idol worship. Oil, and he got those things from the Near Eastern culture. That's the imagery he's going to use. So, God will yet have to use what he used. So once in a while when I think about this, I go back to when Paul says, oh, what the riches of the wisdom of the knowledge of God. How unsearchable. That is, at the end of the day, when you see how it culminated, the way God through history walked through our frailties and ended up presenting Jesus through them in a perfect tense should amaze you every time. In every way. So, by mentioning the words as rotting righteousness, we said the word there, diakosune, justice. What is just and what should be done. We said, therefore, we must go back to their own world. And we looked at a few allusions. I need to remind you also that the use of slavery, for example, by Jesus does not endorse it. I said that the other time. But that was what was available to explain. If you are going to explain forgiveness, forgiveness was understood as paying debts. And there was no better way to explain paying debts like using master-servant. A master-servant is not God who created it, but that is what Jesus had to use to explain forgiveness of sins. Let me see if you understand that. He hasn't endorsed it, but that is what he will need to use to explain forgiveness of sins. In fact, the issue of paying debts on its own, or even owing debts and paying it on its own, cannot be God's creation. Yet, you can't say people cannot owe. People have to owe. So you don't owe me anymore because I'm a Christian. It depends on the amount. If it's negligible, you say 1 billion. I'll be praying for you. Ensure you make it available. Yet, you can't say that you were led by the Spirit to collect it. But what can God do? That's human systems. But he can use that example to explain forgiveness of sins. Who's following what I'm saying here? So I want you to understand grammar. The grammar is critical before we go to the theology of it. So the words are rotten righteousness. You know, and it's good to set this tone well so that you will not be, just like we have done on many areas, you will not be wary of using Old Testament words to explain anything. But of course, I know that before you get there, you shall pass this barrier with your congregation. You have to cross this barrier or else you just say, you are just talking. All this goodness of God that you are talking about, you are just talking reality. You know, but the truth is, you must cross this barrier well enough. And, you know, very technical. So we said that the why is very vital. You can get lost with the what. And you look at something. Let's go back to that Hebrews 11 again. The why is Hebrews 11:1. Substance of things hoped for. That is the hypotasis, pragmaton elpizo. What was believed for? What was seen? What was in view? Or call it the bigger picture. Evidence, electrons, of things not seen. Pragmaton blopiti. That is, things that were not perceived in the natural. So therefore, that is the why. But look at how the word changed. Animal, verse 4. Okay, let's say verse 3. Through faith we understand the walls were framed by the word of God, that the things that were seen were not made of things that do appear. Then verse 4. Through faith, Abel offered. Through faith, Enoch was transcended. See how the experiences have changed. Through faith, Noah prepared an ark. Through faith, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived in tabernacles in the foreign land. Can you see that the experiences have changed? The narrations changed, but the why did not change. The why did not change. The why is verse 1 and verse 2, verse 3, but the what has changed depending on human civilization and the context of their day. A song where they lived, building an ark because there was a flood, being translated when there was long life, having a child when you are barren, going to a foreign land. Okay, we have Isaac, of course, numbered as the seed. Then going to where you have a brother, Ishmael, there's an Isaac who is called the seed. Then you have, so different things in their world. Then you also have Joseph bless his kids and talked about his bones being taken back to the land. So that means he had foreseen they are going to leave the place. Then you talk about Moses being born in Egypt, born properly, then left, came back again, you know, and all that. So the experiences changed. God had to make do with the experiences, yet he had to remain in their consciousness in the faith factor of the experiences, which is the why. They had the Red Sea, you had the destruction of the Egyptians, you had Rahab, the harlot, you have all that. So the experiences change, then you have wars. Then we move from the wars to persecution, and even deaths, and even murders, and even martyrdom. Then it says all of them did not obtain the promise. So, which means that the context of the wars will be the fallen world. The context of the worlds will be man's creation. The what should not be your first line of understanding. It should be what? The why. Now, again, so we said there, of course we talked about wars today. I said wars are, so we have justifiable wars today, right? Come on. Nigeria, okay. Boko Haram in Nigeria killing children is called genocide. Crime against humanity. The Nigerian government sending their own soldiers to battle is justified. Or put the word Daikosune. Right? Come on. A thief coming to steal with a gun, then a shot is justified. Right? A thief stealing biscuit and shot. Ah. No. That's not commensurate. Okay? A kidnapper. So it's justified. Within human systems. What else can we use? I think last time we talked about the criminal justice system, the electric chair, firing squad. Now, the world is reforming and saying you don't have to kill now. I mean, let them, was in Britain that these fellows that killed Amlola Taylor, that stabbed him to death, were released and they came out to commit another crime. Nigeria is now calling their prisons, don't call it prisons, correctional centers. You know, I saw a video of a prison in Norway. It's in Norway now. That had DSTV. Sorry, see my mouth, Nigeria. That had satellite. You could browse the internet. You know, and I kind of felt You know, they allowed them to take exams. We're going to have a job there. And I said, what kind of crime did they commit? I kind of feel like some Nigerians just say, can I go and commit a crime there? Just give me a visa. You go to the consular officer and say, why do you want to go to our country? let me commit a crime, please. I want to commit a crime. Why? So that I can live there. So we're saying that, I mean, God will have to work with that. Don't forget the background. The ideal is Genesis 1 and 2, right? That will remain the ideal. There's nothing you can do. There's no way you can explain it out. That becomes the beginning of all things. So, therefore, in looking at the wars, the first thing we said was that the wars were religious, right? That they had to do with worship. Today, cryptically speaking, it looks like the way we preach the gospel. What we call Christianization agenda. Something of that nature. And the way they will inherit the land is how lands are inherited. That's what they understood. We mentioned the war rhetorics, like Arsenal massacre Chelsea. I don't really like that. Arsenal destroys completely Barcelona. That looks more completely. Complete annihilation. Something like that. Or you say, Barcelona finished. That's more like it, you know. And then you see they are still playing the next week. I thought they are finished. It's just a rhetoric of war. One other thing that I think I want to mention is the fact that the wars had minimal human damage. The intent was to destroy idols in as painless means as possible. As painless means as possible. You know where we came from? We came from there in Egypt. Come on, remember? Come on, are you there? Now, if today if you are sent to go and possess Canaan, you are going to go there. You might even act like you wear their clothes. You might act like you are going to their shrine and start to infiltrate them by preaching. But that's because you have a different civilization. That's why you can relate that way. If I say, now, you are going to, even your Owo needs to, let's say you are going to one village where they, you know, the first thing I remember, one of my friends told me that they went to a place where they didn't wear clothes. You know, and naturally you'll have felt, your own world will be like, what? They felt if you wear clothes, you are from an enemy deity. So, and I said, so how did you do it? He said, do you want to give me details? They actually practically went without clothes. And had to use leaves and all of this. Somebody who has a PhD. So that is true. Now imagine, that is because that's what they will accept. Now, if you are going to possess in the days of Moses, the way they took territories was by war. And even up to recent history. But today, if you hear, go and take over that place. If your pastor sends you and says, go and take over that place. I'm not sure you are going to go and buy guns. You are going to pray. You are going to, you know, look at how do you reach out to people. I remember Uncle Adele told us how the Lord sent him to a school and he had to take the master's degree form to go and be a student. Do you understand? So, now imagine what he has done in their own world. War and conquest will therefore be justified among human beings in how you possess land. I've not yet said they are endorsed by God. We'll get to that at the tail end of this series. But let us first of all understand the language. Why it will say it is wrought in righteousness. Righteousness is not firstly a spiritual word, it's a legal term. It was done legally. Is that clear? It's not the righteousness of God in Christ Jesus in that context alone. It was done legally. It was done rightly. So, that explained, it means that they were meant to destroy idols. How many of you know that is still the Great Commission today? Is that still the Great Commission today? To destroy idols, to stop men from worshiping idols and self and science and all of that to the worship of God. So it now gets us to one critical part of the wars, the Amalekites. I know you know them. The Amalekites. Now, in 1 Samuel 15, in 1 Samuel 15, we often quote verse 22. God help you to quote the context. 1 Samuel 15, 22. To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Do you know what he was supposed to obey? Let's see what he was meant to obey. Verse 3. Go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not. But slay both man and woman, infant, suckling, ox, sheep, camel, and ass. That is what he was meant to obey. But somehow, he spared Agag. He went in there. But in verse 8, he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. And Saul and the people of Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and of the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that he destroyed utterly. So in other words, that was the offense. Now, we will need to understand who the Amalekites were. And like I said, we'll look at it in their world and in today's world. The first thing you will discover that the Amalekites were sworn enemies of Israel. Look at Exodus 17. As they were moving from Egypt, Exodus 17 was their first encounter. Verse 8. Then came Amalek. Verse 8. And fought with Israel in Rephidim. So we see that they have a history of being sworn enemies of Israel. Now look at a couple of things. Israel didn't have trained soldiers. In fact, of all the soldiers in the world, history has it that they had arguably the most amateur and the weakest. And don't forget that these are nomadic people. They are moving, and then you come to attack them in their journey. So they have been sworn enemies of Israel. Now, view Amalekites as ISIS. Or in the words of Barack Obama, ISIL. I think he likes them. Or ISWAP. Or the forgotten Al-Qaeda. Or, let's come home, Boko Haram. View it that way. That this is what you can relate with or relate them with today. So they had an unyielding, unchanging delight and pursuit to destroy Israel. Look at Judges 3:13. And gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and went and smote Israel, and possessed the city of palm trees. Judges 6 verse 3 to 5. I want you to take note of all these texts. Judges 3 verse 3 to 5. 6 verse 3 to 5. It was when Israel was sown that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites drew east, even they came up against them, they encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth till thou comest unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor ass. Can you see it's a consistent thing? Judges 6:33. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites, children of Israel, of children of the east, were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. Judges 7:12. And Midianites and the Amalekites and all children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers in multitudes, and their camels were without number as the sand by the sea. So you see, they are always attacking them on the way. They are like today's what do you call, it's not militant, they call them. Huh? Bandits, not no. What do you call Boko Haram again? Terrorists. That's the way they were. Judges 10:12. There are so many texts. You see them. 10:12. So you have unprovoked attack against Israel. The Zidonites and the Amalekites and the Ammonites did oppress you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. So that is the history they have with Israel. When you say, for example, if President Buhari of Nigeria says to the Chief of Army Staff, General Buratai, go to Zambeza Forest and clear the place. And then he does, he leaves a few people alive. And you hear about it. What man? What would you say? Ah! These people have infiltrated our army. That is in your own world. Today, I don't know anybody who is very Christian and hates his country's army. Not at all. I don't know anybody who understands the gospel of the grace of God so well and goes to talk to the army. Lay down your arms. Our kingdom is not of this world. So what I'm trying to say is, look at those things in their world. They were simply military conquests. But again, we are faced with the issue of language. Utterly destroy them, take them out. We said, this is rhetoric. Because in 1 Samuel 27, now, I skipped something. In 1 Samuel, we just read 1 Samuel 10, chapter 15. In 1 Samuel 15, eventually, Samuel did what Saul did not do. So, you can read that to yourself. But in 1 Samuel 27, so you have the idea that, oh, the Amalekites were cleared, every one of them, you know, women, children, you know, they all died. 1 Samuel 27, verse 8, David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Jezreelites and the Amalekites. For those nations were as of old inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even the land of Egypt. So that means that utterly destroyed, that eventually Samuel was meant to have done, is another war rhetoric. They didn't all die. In 1 Samuel 30 and verse 1, it says that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire. They're just known bandits and terrorists. In 1 Samuel 30 again, verse 18 and 17, David recovered all the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. That's David for you. Even after David, about 250 years later, in 1 Chronicles chapter 4, 250 years about that, 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 43, First Chronicles 4 and 43. And they smote the rest of the Amalekites that were escaped and dwelt there to this day. So that means that that language of utterly destroy is another war rhetoric. In fact, when you now read the story of Esther, you know, Esther is quite a later event, where they were in exile under the Persian king of the Ahasuerus. You now have Haman. Look at Esther. Esther 3:1. Esther chapter 3 and 1. And these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman the son of Amedata, the Agagite. That means he's the son of Agag, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. So you still had someone who was from that same lineage, from King Agag. Look at chapter 3 verse 10. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman. Follow this. The son of Amadatha, the Agagite, the Jews' what? Enemy. So that's what they were. Look at verse 13. And the letters were sent by post to the king's room to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young, old, little children, women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So you can see they are sworn enemies of the Jews. So the issue with the Amalekites was more of the Jews being on the defensive, preservative. And two things we're going to look at again. We said that the utterly destroy is war rhetoric, right? Okay, good. Secondly, it is like a war against terrorists. Those who are consistently against your soul. Deuteronomy 25. Moses spoke about this. Verse 15 to 17. Thou shalt have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and just measure thou shalt have, and thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. For all that do such things and all that unrighteous are unbelieving unto the God thy God, remember what the Amalekites did unto thee by the way when you were come out. That is, they are known enemies. So, call them hardened against Israel. But, obviously, when you hear utterly destroyed, let's now go to some basic technical details of war rhetoric. In 1 Samuel 15, and sometimes you may need some, I guess, maybe as we go on, we'll look at some archaeological materials that explain these things so that we don't just get carried away by what we can call surface reading. 1 Samuel 15 verse 5. So when he was told to do that, what did he do? He came to a city of the Amalek and laid wait in the valley. He came to the city and laid wait in the valley. What this appears is like a fortified military camp. You know, if you say, for example, that Egypt destroyed, say, Lebanon at war, you are actually talking about their soldiers, their military men. So have that at the back of your mind. So basically, that word destroy, I mentioned it earlier, is the word Erem. We'll explore it on Monday likely, which is used for to ban something. It's used for resistance, it's used for to bar another. And it is the most used language for Israel's war against other nations, particularly the Canaanites. Against Canaanites is used 37 times. Erem. H-E-R-E-M. And a synonym of it is used about 10 times about the Amalekites. So therefore, what it talks about more is not literally just a physical destruction of material things. No. It's more of to bar something from happening. Now, knowing the culture of their day, the way out of that will be to resort to wars. Just put that somewhere. The question now will be, why the inclusion of women and children in 1 Samuel 15? We've crossed the Judges and Joshua angle and seen that, well, that doesn't look like everybody was touched. But what about this clear instruction of women and children and everything that moves? Yet again, we are dealing with language. The issue against the Amalekites had to do with their combatant citizens, their military, and not non-combatant members of society. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 20. And verse 10. When you come near to a city to fight against it, watch this procedure for war. Pay attention, please. It says, proclaim peace unto it. So the first step of war was, look, bring peace. Proclaim peace. And it shall be, if it makes the answer of peace and open unto thee, it shall be that all good that is found there shall be tributed unto thee, and they shall serve thee. Peace. It will make no peace to thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath given it into thy hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. Pay attention. But the women and little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, thou shalt take unto yourself, and thou shalt eat of the spoil of thy enemy, the Lord thy God hath given thee. Thou shalt do unto all the cities which are far off from thee, which are not the cities of these nations, but the cities of these people which the Lord thy God hath given thee an inheritance. Thou shalt have alive, save alive, nothing that breathe. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord thy God. Pay attention here. Pay attention here. I'll command it. It appears that, okay, destroy them. Then it says in 18, thou, they shall teach you not to do after their own abominations what they have done unto their gods, so you should not sin against the Lord your God. So you can see again that the intent is worship. And it doesn't mean to kill. It actually means to bar for the purpose of consecration. So critically, therefore, it means that the word Aram, another synonym of it is Aram, does not refer to destruction of everybody living. It actually has to do with war against those who are the soldiers or the militants or the warriors. So when you look at Joshua 6 and 21, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and ass, and with the edge of the sword. That looks a little bit contradictory. Now, that word men and women is found about 7 times in Old Testament history and books around scriptures. Let's see the implication. Joshua 8:25. So all that fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, even of the men, all of the men of Ai. 1 Samuel 15:3, Amalek. 1 Samuel 22:19. Not the city of the priest, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children, sucklings, oxen, asses, sheep, with the edge of the sword. Children are mentioned here. Nehemiah 8:2. Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both of men and women, all that could hear with understanding, upon the first day of the seventh month. Men and women again. 2 Samuel 6:19. And dwelt among all people, among the old ones of Israel, as well to the women as men, to everyone a cake of bread, and a good piece of flesh, and a flagon of oil. So all the people departed, everyone to his house. Then 2 Chronicles 16:3, just similar. Now, notice this. Every time you read this text, you find the word all used, except in 1 Samuel 22:20. Every time you see the word all. And the word all is the Hebrew word kol, K-O-L. All. K-O-L. Now, you notice statements like, we captured all cities in the time and destroyed the men, women, and children. We left no survivor. We destroyed everybody. Chapter 3, verse 6. Again. So, this is another use of words that we must pay attention to. We have said already that, yes, the word all was used, but every time it was used, we still had the residue of inhabitants that were not touched. So what it means is that this all had a lot of exceptions. The use of the word all always has exceptions. So this ban, or these destructions, the Aram or the Aram, had exceptions. You might have to read the story to the end to know whether the all is everything or was specific. Let us see examples. Joshua 6:21, where he mentioned men, women, young and old, cattle and sheep. Then he said, pay attention, that 12,000 men and women fell. Joshua 8:25. The truth of the matter is, archaeologically in history, both Jericho and Ai did not have civilian populations in history. They were military formations. Both Jericho and Ai, that is Jericho that we speak of, and Ai, the one we just read now, they never had civilian populations. Jericho and Ai were military strongholds. Jericho actually, that is why you have the walls of Jericho. People don't probably understand what it means. It's a military fortress. It's like a camp of soldiers. So it was used, that wall was used as a defense at junctions of Jerusalem, Bethel, and Ophah. Ophah is spelled O-R-P-H-A-H. P-A-A-H. They were like military formations. Ai and Jericho. So why then the use of men, women, cattle? The language all is another exaggerated term of war. It simply meant they took the city, they took the country, they finished off the nation. It doesn't literally mean that women and children were killed. In fact, the word city in Hebrew is the word IR, IR, which gives us the idea of a specialized formation. So they are like government buildings used for operations and all of that. In one of the ancient materials, particularly the Amarna letters, A-M-A-R-N-A, written about the 14th century before Christ, it says that whenever Egyptians and the Canaan leaders, when they exchanged letters and stuff like that, they did it through the fortress of the military formations. In other words, the military formations were first before you reached where their populations resided. So you always had like a fortress before you enter into the city. It's called the gates. And in the gates you had the military formations. For example, you know that David did the same in the 2 Samuel 5 and 7, where he had Zion. 2 Samuel 5 and 7, he took the stronghold of Zion, that is the same city of David. So David also had the habit of building a fortress, 1 Chronicles 11 verse 5 and 7, 2 Samuel 12, 26. The way we have toll gates, where you just pay money. In their own, it was a city for governance. Governance was put there. The elders and the rulers and the governments will be there. The military formations were there. So every time you see war and you hear the city was run over, it's a military term. It means that they defeated the military. It doesn't literally mean that children were taken and killed wholesale. And of course, when you start reading the word kingdom, the Hebrew word melech, melech is, doesn't refer to the people there as much as the authorities also there. So archaeologically, like I mentioned, and of course, reading scriptures well in context, you discover that that phrase had to do with battle. Battle. Battle between two military formations and not genocide or total cleansing of human beings. Let's look at a typical example. Why do you think that the children of Israel had to go around the wall of Jericho and did it seven times on the same day? Oftentimes people think they were just there praising God and worshiping. We'll see that as we proceed. Jericho, therefore, historically speaking, I have something here. Jericho, therefore, was a small settlement of maybe 100 or less than soldiers. That is why they could circle it seven times and then do battle the same day. If it was like a whole city as big as Lagos, can you even do it once? So it was a military formation that they were circling. So therefore, then again, the use of the word thousands, I must mention this. In the Hebrew, the latter day language now uses thousands the way we do. The word is the Hebrew word eleph. E-L-E-P-H. It doesn't exactly refer to numbers. Some old Hebrew dictionaries have it as a unit or a squad. Sometimes 10 people can be called 1,000. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, 10,000 exactly refers to a unit of the army. So it's not 1,000 literally speaking. And I said that because at that time, the use of thousand had not, just like you don't find millions in the Bible, because when it was translated into Greek, they didn't have millions to use. By the time the Bible was brought into the Septuagint, thousands were already being used. So it was used to talk about a number of people, legion, for example. So the word thousands is just a few, maybe today, maybe a battalion, two or three, like that. So Jericho was what it was, which is a military formation. That means everyone that was killed were soldiers. It's what you call like a military outpost. Which means that non-combatant people weren't found there. Maybe kings, maybe those in authority, but basically, it wasn't just entering into people's houses and killing the children, no. Let me see if I follow what I'm talking about here. So those are things that will require us to be careful. It's, we said today, is a war justified? We said yes. A military battle? Of course yes. So we look at it and say, well, in the context of that day, the walls of Jericho is like going to, there's no Dodan Barracks. Is this the Dodan Barracks? Is this still as functional? Dodan Barracks. But that was even in the center of the city. They will have entered very well. The way they did it was that at the Zion, for example, was David's fortress where he held his kingdom, where he had his soldiers, his military strength, and all of that. So that's what Jericho was like. So therefore, it would mean that the destruction of the Amalekites as well, done by Saul, was not the women and the children. It was basically taking out the military commanders, etc., etc. So men and women is a short form of saying we took the whole place. I mismentioned this. Part of the Hebraism and Hebrew language is to, when I say, for example, if you know, Jesus spoke about you can't enter into a strong man's house except you bind the strong man, then you spoil his goods. Now, the person you bound is the strong man. But what you spoiled are his goods. So, when you kill the strong man, for example, you now say, you've taken the children. You've taken the women. It's like, you've taken them with him. So, it's a language of conquest, not of cleansing. Are we making sense? So, it's not a language of annihilation. Nope. Therefore, just like the Amalekites, Jericho was like a military fortress. And that's what happened in that instance. Amen. Is this helping us? So we must first of all get the grammar. If you don't get the grammar and the context, so it's the military, the formations that were at Jericho. Or like the way you had to enter the city. And I think that somehow the New Testament Greek will call it, that's why we have the gates of hell. You understand? The gates of hell should not prevail. You know, the Septuagint puts it in this format. The gates of hell should not prevail. And then you will wonder, gates. In your own mind, you are thinking gates. In fact, if you get to civilized country, they don't use gates. So, but the gates will mean the fortresses. So the gates of the place of the dead will not prevail against it. So now imagine a city having gates. The gates are not just edifices. They have soldiers. So when I say the gates of hell should not prevail against it, that takes you back to the cryptic imagery of the wars of the Old Testament, where it was a combatant war, not war against humanity. Are we making sense? Now this leads us to another important personality within the story of the conquest, and that is Rahab. Rahab the harlot. In Joshua chapter 2, are we not systematically studying Joshua like this? Eh? It just make it easier when we get there, right? Uh-huh. Because no matter how much of the New Testament you understand, if you get to these instances, just say, well, you know, it's the Old Testament, they are not born again, you know, might not suffice. And you know, we are in a world where people are asking questions. Your children are going to ask you. You know, when we were young, we were not given room to even ask. If you say, ah, but daddy, why would God ask them to level the place? It's a slap that will make you know why. Bah! You want to start serving the devil at this age? Because they also didn't have the answers. Well, we must rise up to the task. Amen. Okay. So that comes to Rahab. A slightly controversial figure because of a whole lot of, you know, ideas behind her. But let's see Joshua 2. Joshua the son of Nun sent out. I know your mind is so pure, but there's something you are probably didn't see. Out of Shittim, two men to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, even Jericho. And they went and came into an harlot house named Rahab and lodged there. Your mind is so pure that you are not thinking how a non-believer would think. Two men of God went to lodge in the house of a prostitute. That's not how it is. You know, emoji. But the truth is, historically speaking, and we need to understand that, in the fortresses, they used to have what they call taverns, law inns. That is, when they have these military fortresses, you had inns there, and they would not have maybe women, non-combatant people, who will keep those inns for travelers, messengers. The Umurabi tradition and code tells us that in the Near Eastern tradition, they had female innkeepers. So they had this law, the Umurabi code had this law. Let me read it for you. If conspirators against the city meet in the house of a female tavern keeper, tavern is spelled T-A-V-E-R-N, and these conspirators are not captured and delivered to the courts, the tavern keeper shall be put to death. So you can imagine what she did. If there's a discovery of conspirators and she, the tavern keeper, like somebody who has a guest house, if she keeps them from these authorities, the result is death. So it's not just that she was doing boju boju and then they didn't get the guys and they left her. No, what she did was to put her life at risk, you know, eventually. Now, so the truth is, those things were common in those days, even among the Hittites. So at some time, when it now became a ploy by enemies to penetrate through those inns, because those inns were serving like resource centers for military people, traveling people, and all of that, you know, across, just like the way you have, if you go to the US, for example, even Nigeria here, you discover that at airports, you have hotels. People are coming around where they first rest, and when you get to some, in fact, if you are in the US, because it's more desirable to travel by road, you will like it, but I don't like it. If you go by road, you will see on the road, at almost the entrance of every city, at the exit, you will find inns where you can lodge. It's assumed that, okay, you're tired before you get in and all that. So that was the tradition. So she was a keeper of one of such places at the entrance of the city. Now, it therefore will be an ideal place for spies to stay and those who are conspiring against the city. Now, the non-believing mind will think, what did they go in to do in the house of Rahab? Notice the use of words. They came into the Allah's house. If they had sexual relations, Old Testament language is very clear. It would be they came into her. So that means they lodged there and did not have sex with her. And in fact, in Judges 16 verse 1, in Samson's case, he went into her, not into her house. So the taverns, those inns were used for sexual pleasure, used for, you know, but they were also used for spies and just a place to lodge. So the key issue there is Rahab had a place where people would lodge and the spies took advantage of it. Now it's vital to know also that unlike Rahab and her family, fellow Canaanites or those in Jericho refused to acknowledge God. Let me make some very vital points. And I think I really need you to pay attention to this. What then will be the offense of Canaan? Was it that we're coming to your house and you refuse us entrance? We've seen the protocol of war, peace, shalom. And you say, no, it's war. If you want peace, we'll give you peace. If you want war, we'll give you war. That was the code. But there was something underlining that should not be missing. The truth is, Canaan refused to believe in God. That was key. They refused to acknowledge his lordship over the world. They refused him as the creator. To know this well is to look at the utterance of Rahab. Joshua 2. Verse 9. Now, you will have thought this is Canaan. They are living from Egypt. Because they are, you know, I've said this before. What about those who did not hear the gospel? I said it's not a question in the Bible. It's only a curiosity that has no basis. Now, let's track this very well. These folks are leaving Egypt. They've never been to Canaan before. The worst is that they sent spies who went there, were scared and returned. But look at what Rahab said. Joshua 2 verse 9. I know the Lord had given you the land. Pay attention. And that your terror is falling upon us. And that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. Let's take verse 10 together. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when he came out of Egypt, and what you did unto the two kings of the Amorites, and were on the other side Jordan, Sihon, and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God, and above, and in heaven above, and in earth beneath. So can you see that there was a prior information? You know, I said to us that idolatry is oftentimes a reaction to the worship of God. It's a replacement. So she knew, and her family acknowledged it. They knew what God did in Egypt. They had a good report of him. Look at chapter 9 verse 9. You know, there was a tribe that they rescued. If you notice, where the Gibeonites, those who were in Gibeon, that weren't affected. Do you know why? Look at chapter 9 verse 9. From a very far country thy servants are come. They said unto him, because of the name of the Lord thy God, for we have heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt. They knew. They had heard it. They are reporting back Exodus 15, 14 to 17. Deuteronomy chapter 2 verse 25. Did you also notice that Nineveh knew about God? They knew before Jonah came. So the thing is, it's not like an unjustified action, totally speaking. These are people that knew. They heard. And he said, God had given you the land. So what we are finding is a people who, again, we're not you're talking about the role of God here. We're just basically looking at the justification of the wars and why did they happen. They knew. And every land was possessed by what? Conquest. If you trace every land, you'll get back to the first man, Adam. Who made Adam? So eventually, you discover that this is not just a mere acquisition of land, it's a refusal to acknowledge the lordship of Yahweh God. So, can we therefore say that, listen carefully, both the whole land of Canaan, from Jericho, the Gibeonites, the Perizzites, Jebusites, that's the part I don't like mentioning. Jebusites. Well, it's not a Jebusite, it's Jebusites. My conscience is clear. But you know that there was none of them that did not see the signs of God's power. They saw it. So that's why Jesus in Luke 16, 31 says, look, if they will not hear Moses and the prophets, even if one shall rise from the dead, they will still not be persuaded. So they had heard about the gods of Egypt, how they were disgraced. And therefore, Rahab knew that the Gibeonites knew. And definitely the entire land knew. So it wasn't just an invasion. Unexpectedly. Like we have said, they went around seven times of the war, which symbolized, and let's see how they did it. What exactly did they do? Joshua 6 and 3. You shall encompass the city, you men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus, so it wasn't like everyone, it was the soldiers. Now, the word encompass there, the city, go round, in the Hebrew, is the word nakap, N-A-Q-A-P. It means a circle. It involves blowing horns, sacred procession, the shouting of the name of God. In fact, in Psalm 48, it's described as walking about Zion, counting our towers, considering our ramparts. You see allusions of this in 2 Kings 6 and 14, 2 Samuel 6 verse 15 to 16. So in other words, it meant that they went around in like an appeal, an opportunity to evade destruction, an opportunity to not refuse but to acknowledge. Then it was refused. Once again, those who circled it were men of war, and what they circled were fortresses of war. Hope that is clear. Now, but again, the question is, why so many wars? We have said, historically speaking, wars are part of human history. It has nothing to do with the worship of God. It just has everything to do with human history. People have accused the Bible of being responsible for wars. The Bible has instigated wars. Some even say the Bible instigated the Second World War, the Bible instigated the Crusades, and all of that. They are far from the truth. Because, literally speaking, we have a whole lot of historical documents about wars that are, in fact, from all history, and you could check this out yourself, the Israel's wars were the, call it lightweight. They are like, you have super heavyweight, you have heavyweight, you have middleweight, you have featherweight. What else can exist? Lightweight. What else can exist? You have the streetweight. They're just pushing punches on the road. Compared to all the wars of their time, the wars of Israel were the mildest. I'll give you some wars to check up in history. The Hittite and Egyptian wars, second millennium, just about 1000 BC. The Aramean, A-R-A-M-E-M-A-E-A-N. The Assyrian wars, Babylonian wars, Persian wars. In fact, maybe I should mention this. In a particular document, the New Assyrian Annals, New Assyrian Annals of the Ashur-Nasir-Pal, A-S-H-U-R-N-A-S-I-R-P-A-L, the second, between 883 to 859 BC. Let's see what he describes. Their heads were on the poles, their bodies was for show. I took their bodies, placed them on piles. I put out their eyes. I cut off their ears and limbs. I put their heads and took it around the city. In fact, I read the history of our wars in Yoruba land. They would cut someone's head and take it around. It was like conquest. That was in the Bible. So the truth is, the Israel wars were the mildest of their day. What I'm trying to say, it therefore becomes very unfair to say that those wars were isolated or they were on their own. No. So the first thing we need to put in mind and also realize is that the wars were just wars of their day. Wars were typical. And theirs were the mildest, just like we examined their criminal justice system, was the mildest of their day. That was their world. And if you notice also, they came out of the land of Egypt that was known for wars. It wasn't God that gave Abraham armed men. That was just their world. That was how they knew to claim territories. But eventually Abraham knew that there was no land to claim after having soldiers. God said, lift up your eyes. Look at it. I've given them all to you. So we have to be able to juxtapose what God intended, okay, but what was present in their own world. Their inability to marry that will be a serious theological confusion. The second thing we need to also notice is that majority of the wars Israel fought were defensive in nature. We have examined a few. Exodus 17, the ones against the Amalekites, verse 8 was defensive. Numbers 21 also was defensive. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 26 to 30 was defensive. Numbers 31, verse 2 to 3, defensive. Numbers 31, verse 16, they were all defensive. Joshua 10 and 4. So, there was a whole lot of defensive battles. It was defensive. It was, okay, along the way, they met this, they attacked them, they had to, you know, defend themselves, and all of that. Also, it's noted that God stopped them from going to neighboring nations. Moab and Amnon were prohibited. They shouldn't go there. Moab and Amnon. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 9 and 19. Also, Edom. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 4 to 5. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 7. Even though those ones didn't assist them and didn't help them. You could check out their history. Numbers 20, verse 14 to 21. Also, they were not meant to grab land, steal land and all of that. So all the battles in the time of Joshua that appeared were sanctioned by God. Pay attention. They were all defensive. Joshua 10 to 11. Were there offensive wars that took place? Even the time of David, yes. But the fact that they happened didn't mean they were ideal or exemplary. We may need to look at them, you know, in their own context. So, a few takeaways. One, there were wars in their days. Theirs were the lightest, almost the weakest of the battles. Because they didn't even have trained military men. The second thing is, and very critically, was that most of their wars were defensive in nature. They were not allowed to, and they weren't supposed to fight everybody. And then, more so, they were banned or barred from touching certain nations, even nations that didn't like them. So that means we must qualify their wars appropriately. Let's take one more, and then we look at another set of people, the Midianites. We found them with the Amalekites as well. The Midianites were equally sworn enemies of Israel. Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 to 19. Remember what the Amalekites did to you by the way when you come out of Egypt, and how he met thee by the way, smote the innermost of thee, that all were feeble behind thee, and thou was faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore, Amalek, sorry, it shall be when the Lord thy God had given thee the rest of thy enemies around about in the land the Lord had given thee for inheritance to possess it, thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it. So, just like this, the Midianites were equally sworn enemies. It's the Midianites that had Balaam, you know, in Numbers 24, 25, and all that. And the plan of Balaam was get Israel to worship an idol. Numbers 25, verse 1 to 2. Numbers 31, verse 16. He was the one that couldn't bring a curse on Israel. Numbers 22 to 24. Then he sought the way of idol worship. So, look at Numbers 31. Something Moses gave. Verse 17 to 18. Kill every male and little ones. So, kill every woman that no man by line with him, and all the women, children, that I've not known a man by lying with him keep alive for yourselves. Yeah, we're going to explore that. So he says, touch everybody, but not the women that have not chosen to have illicit sex with you. So for the males, yes. Because they were potential enemy threats in the sense of the anami. But the women, the reason he says no, leave the women alone, was because he felt, look, these ones did not constitute themselves as a nuisance to want you to worship, you know, idols. So they were kept like POWs, what you can call prisoners of war. But don't forget, now people have said that, well, when he said keep them to yourself, he meant that they should use them as sex objects. That is ridiculous. It's too presumptuous. In Deuteronomy chapter 21 verse 10 to 14, Moses had already given an instruction that when you take a prisoner of war, it mustn't be used as a sex slave or object. Deuteronomy 21 verse 10 to 14. Read 14. The women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, also thou shalt take unto yourself, thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies, the Lord hath given thee. And so it's basically as a prisoner of war and not as a sex slave. Again, let's recollect the war procedure. The first thing is entreaty of peace. When there's no peace, when there's war, you go all out for war. That's why the Gibeonites were able to make peace, because you can now understand what Rahab did. Oh, no problem, we're fine. I mean, we have peace with you. And then there's nothing. But those that made wars were the ones they made wars with. Look at Joshua 11:19. I'll start from 18. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeonites. All others they took in battle. For it was of the Lord to add in their hearts that they should come against Israel in the battle, that he might destroy them utterly, that they might have no favor, but that he might destroy them even as the Lord commanded Moses. So you can see that there was the place of making peace, making peaceful offers, interest and all of that. Again, don't forget that the background of all this is idol worship. Okay, we have brought God, we have brought Jehovah, and Paul will say, to those who believe it's life, to those who don't believe it's what? Death. Look at the cryptic imagery that Paul is using, taking the wars. All of Paul's explanation about the preaching of the gospel are warfare terminologies. Beneath them, life, death, condemnation. Don't forget that the Greek word for condemnation is to convict somebody for punishment and death. So when someone is condemned for not believing, that is behind that is a statement. In the background is the warlike terminologies used in Israel. Hope you are learning something. So let's take one or two things then. Call it today. So, critically we said the language must be understood. The language and then the context of what was going on. I'll remind you again that war is part of the fallen world. It's still part of us today. That's why nations come together often to make entreaties. We have one of the weakest is the African Union. I don't know what they are. Well, they try to... But when NATO threatens, you just be... Sermonizing. It's not fair. It's not fair. You don't say we don't care. Eh? You have to care. I don't know which of the governments was there that the United States brought their naval ship across Lagos just to oversee. They are threatening our sovereignty because they know that if you just five of them, they enter Lagos. And they just say, we are buying you over. And what the only thing America to make all of us subservient? Nothing. They just enter the city, and then the governor of Lagos say, no, I'm the governor of this state till now. They asked him, step down, kneel down. By the time they take over all the military formations, and then they say, oh, thank God we are not Americans. He said, nope, they're American slaves. I mean, it's just the way it goes. So it shows that in our world today, it's just the same thing. Just that we have civilized war in such a way that we now have those things are basically put under a lot of restriction. Let's take one or two things and then we call it a day. So the concept of driving them out is another statement we must look at. What does it mean to drive them out? Again, in our own world, it means to evict people from a place. That's the way we see it. But that language is more of dispossessing people of the land. Numbers 21 verse 32. Numbers 21 verse 32. Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and he took the villages thereof and drove out the Amorites that were there. Deuteronomy chapter 9 verse 1. Thou art to pass over Jordan to this day to go into possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven. Deuteronomy 11:23, just put that in reference. Deuteronomy 18:14, Deuteronomy 19 verse 1. Now look at Exodus 23, verse 27 to 30. I'll just take a text there. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field may become too numerous for you. I will drive them out little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. So driving out or taking possession is not wiping people off. It's expulsion, okay, and not annihilation. The word dispossess is the Hebrew word yarash. Y-A-R-A-C-H. It's used in Exodus 34:24, Numbers 32 verse 21, Deuteronomy chapter 4 verse 38. And let this be in your mind. Genesis 3:24, Adam and Eve, they were not killed. Or Cain in the wilderness, Genesis 4:14. Or David was driven from Israel by Saul, 1 Samuel 26 and 19. So the idea is not to kill people, but to cast them out. So to send out will just mean not to kill, destroy, annihilate. Leviticus 18:24, just other references. Leviticus 20:23. So it basically is not to annihilate people or to consume them. It's more of the land. And we have seen that it is systematic. It has to do with taking care of the idols, places of worship. We're going to see something fundamental here on Monday. And it says, yeah. So it's not, what is meant there has more to do with cultural, theological, and worship than with material substance. So all the wars must be viewed, you know, in their own world and in their own way. Like I said, and I'll just call it a day on this, that the Old Testament was those who we can call righteousness, justified ones, did not do anything to non-combatants, non-military people, no. It was basically war, which in today's terms is still justified within human civilization and systems. We've looked at the women and children used, that was just a phrase, it's not literally speaking, and then said the whole place was entirely destroyed, or they drove them out. Had nothing to do with death, it rather had to do with the possession of the place in question. So we must keep looking at the language, and we'll do that, continue that. And when we solve the language, up to the every war, majorly, we try to see as many as we can see, then we come to the context of it, which we have approached in the world, and why. Then today was the theology behind it. So the truth is, we mustn't take it out of their world. It would be very dishonest and unfair to take something that happened 4,000 years ago and relate it as though it happened last year. You must relate it with what was happening in their world at that time. And like we said, conquests or lands were taken over by conquest. What you call Nigeria today, Lagos, people will tell you histories of kings, nobles, wars fought here and there, civil wars, different wars. America, Great Britain, France, Europe are all a product of wars. They claim lands. There's somewhere in, I think South America, they're still under Britain or something because of war. They claim the place. And then till now, they're finding a way to explain it. You know, I think so. I'll get the details if I can. So the truth is, it's part of the fallen world. There's no way we can divorce that from their day. So we'll look at the different other wars later on, and approach it from that point, so that we can now talk about God afterwards. Amen. Because to throw everything under the bus, in the name of Jesus has come, let's forget it, is to have a lot of things unexplained. But we must see, first and foremost, that they were typical wars, not different from what we see today. The only difference is that these ones serve God. And today, I don't think if anybody says they serve God and their military is strong, you are going to call their God evil. Amen.